So let's skip on the recording. There we go. All right. So as I said, that was really just the principle. If people missed the last point, the only point I was making was that most questions do not fall into this category. Okay, most questions do not fall into this category. They're going to fall into the next category, which is as follows. So now we've talked about Bittel Barreau, which is a simple majority. That's all you need. So that's 2 versus 1, effectively, right? So you have 2 pieces of kosher versus 1 piece of non-kosher. Right, that's a much simpler majority. But there is also a principle of what we call Bittel B'Shishim, which means you need 1 part in 60. And as long as it's less than 1 part in 60, then that will be enough. The 59 parts will be enough to nullify the 60th part. When does that apply? So that applies in the cases that we mentioned before, or the opposite of the cases that we mentioned before. So we were talking before about dry, and we were talking about things which are basically the same. So a piece of kosher chicken with a piece of non-kosher chicken, 2 kosher chickens with a non-kosher chicken. Now we're talking about something which is different, and something which is which has a sauce, which has a liquid, which is much, much more common. So again, the classic case that people like to talk about. I don't know if this really happened. I can't think of any questions I've had specifically with this, but people often talk about you spill a drop of milk accidentally into your chicken soup, right? So there, a majority is not enough, right? Majority wouldn't cut it if you managed to spill an entire bottle of milk into your chicken soup. Even if you have the majority of it as chicken soup, that doesn't work. What you need to have is 59 times the amount, or 60 times the amount of chicken soup, 59 times chicken soup for every 1 part of milk that has fallen in. Obviously, this is going to be an estimate, and obviously, we're going to try and be a little bit careful with this. But in principle, what you need to have is 1 in 60. Again, this is very straight out of the Gemara, based on various verses, but particularly drawn from here in Parashat. Parashat Noso, I think, towards the beginning of Parashat Noso. Omer of Chia Bar Abba, if anybody wants to follow inside the source over here, Omer of Chia Bar Abba, Omer of Yeshua ben Levi, Mashum Bar Kapara, Kol Isurim Shabbatot. This applies to every prohibition in the Torah, every prohibited substance in the Torah. Now, most of the time when the Gemara says that, right, that means it's like alarm bells for me. Because it's never all, and we'll go through all of the exceptions a little bit later on. We say every prohibition in the Torah is permitted in 60 parts. That's not true. It's not every single one. We'll come back to some of the other ones a bit later. As it says, "V'loka hakon es hazara b'sheila." This is based on the based on sort of a part of an animal that the Kohen used to eat, and the estimation of sort of the size of this part versus the rest of the animal is 1 in 60, and based on that ratio, that is. That is where we get the idea of 1 in 16, and that is where we get this idea of bittel, of nullification, which works 1 in 16. So, just to come back to our question, let's say you put more than the milk spoon, right? Even without the milk spoon, that just you put milk, you accidentally put milk into your chicken soup, right? Then, as long as you have 1 in 16, chicken soup is still good. Would many people here eat it? Probably not. Would I eat it? I don't know, but I should do, really. I should sort of galvanize myself to eat it, because 100% kosher, no problem with that at all. And again, there are many situations in which you don't have much of a choice, and so we rely on this regularly, because it's this is very much part of Jewish law. However, one important caveat: my grandfather always used to like to tell the joke about the Rebbetzin's chicken soup tasting better than everybody else's, because she used to add one tiny drop of milk into her chicken soup, and that was fine because it was only 1 in 60. So that doesn't work. That doesn't work. And again, everybody's very clear on that. The Shulchan Aruch says, "Ein mavatlin Israel lechatchila." You cannot actively, you cannot sort of a priori go and actively do this nullification, right? What you have to do, if it happens, then yes, you can rely on that. But you cannot go and do that sort of in principle, sort of set out with that in mind. Now that's this, although the milk and the in the chicken soup is probably a bit of a joke, this actually does have quite significant ramifications, and there are a number of areas in which this comes up, particularly with sort of things that are an area of gelatin and things like that. So sometimes you can have sort of, it gets broken down to a point where it's no longer considered food, and whether that's considered to be lahatkila or not, whether that's considered to be sort of putting something into a substance which is considered, you know, which is sort of designed to nullify from the beginning, that that is something which is very, very highly debated amongst different kashrut organizations. But in principle, as I say, as a general rule, one is not allowed to actively choose to nullify something, but when it happens, you're 100% permitted to rely on it. Okay. Now we come to some of the exceptions, and then we're going to stop the questions. So a few exceptions, and then feel free to ask. So some of the exceptions, we'll jump through a few of them. One of them is chametz, okay? So chametz and Pesach considered to be very, very severe, and therefore even 1 in 60 is not going to be enough. That's why we're very, very careful with chametz to get rid of every tiny drop, try and avoid that totally. And a few of the other classic ones are basically if you can see it, right? So if you can see the crab claw that has fallen into your chicken salad, you cannot say that is nullified because it's less than 1 in 60. Just pull it out and don't eat it, right? You might be tempted, but that doesn't work. If you can see it, that doesn't work. One of the other things that comes up pretty regularly is rennet and cheese. Okay, so rennet and cheese is always less than 1 in 60, but it's what's called a davar hamatmid. So the sort of the entire cheese is created through that, and therefore to have non-kosher rennet and cheese is problematic, even though it's less than 1 in 60. Okay, so those are some of the exceptions. Okay, pause for any questions. Any questions, any thoughts, any comments?
Rabbi, can you go back to the last slide?
Sure.
So the third one down.
Yes.
Something for which the problem could be solved, e.g. tevel.
Okay, so let me explain what that is. Dovah sheyesh lematirin means that that basically you can. Okay, so tevel is basically as follows. Tevel is fruits and vegetables or produce in Israel before it has had the required amounts removed from it. So when you grow produce in Israel, you have to give 10%. There's truma and there's maser and there's various things you have to do to it before you can eat it, right? So now let's say you have your orange and you know that you haven't taken truma off this orange and it drops in with all of your other oranges, right? So there, that's what's called a davar sheyesh lematirin, because what you can do is you can take a piece off, and since you're able to solve the problem, so you cannot just rely on bittul in that case. Some say that chametz falls into this category, but most disagree. Some say that chametz falls into this category because it will become permitted again in a few days' time. Right? So all you need to do is wait another week, and then it's fine. Most don't. But anyway, that's a big discussion in and of itself. But as I said, if there's a way to sort of solve the problem, then that's what you should do as well. That also doesn't get nullified. But good question.
So, sorry, there's a follow-up to that.
Yes.
There's this, and this may be one you'll come on to later, in which case please postpone the answer. But there's this word that I hear, which is toivol.
Right.
Is that related or unrelated?
That's a good question. Cool. I wasn't going to come on to that. We could do that in a different part of the series. Toiveling is slightly different because toiveling is really, so toivel is when you is a commandment. So it's not a prohibition, it's a commandment in a sense, where a person is required to put certain types of utensils, let's say basically sort of glass and metal utensils that are used with food, into a mikveh before the first time they're used. So while one shouldn't use utensils without having done that, it doesn't actually render the food prohibited in a sense, right? It's a mitzvah, it's a commandment to do that. But if you're served something on that, you know, on that sort of substance, it doesn't make the food prohibited. So no, it doesn't really fall into this category per se, although it does link to kosher in a sense. Yes, Lynn.
Yes, many, many years ago when Rabbi Grunwald was Rabbi at Pinna, I'd come back from abroad and I brought back some saucepans with me. And I wanted to, I'd use them for meat. They were new and I'd use them for meat in Denmark. But I had so many back home already. And I said to him, is there any way I can make these so I can use them for milk? So he said, yes. So what he did was he got this enormous chisel of boiling water, filled his, I think that was coil oil. He filled it to the very top, put a brick in it. So it all came over. I mean, we nearly scalded ourselves and then dunked the pans in there.
I think there's a few...
What was all that about? I mean, he did explain
there's a
the
few
time.
Different but... things, there's a few different things that have got, I think... sort of put into that story. So that's not tithing, that's what we call kashering. That's where there has been something prohibited or something that's going to... Well, let's come back to that question. We're going to save that question for the end, okay? Let's come back to that question, which is basically if something is non-kosher or if you can't use it as it is, then what exactly do you do? So let's come back to that at the end. That's called kashering, different
right.
to tithing, although they both involve or can both involve water. Very good question.
Okay.
All right. I realize now I can only see three people here. So I'm assuming if anybody else does have questions, you just have to unmute yourself. I'll scroll down a little. Doesn't look like we have any more questions. All right. So, okay. So that was really. We've only talked about the food itself. We've talked about milk going into meat, but we're really dealing with a spoon, right? So a spoon is not made of milk. A spoon is not made of meat. So where do we get this idea that your spoon going into your chicken soup might be a problem? So here we come on to what's called taste, what we call ta'am ke'ikar. Ta'am ke'ikar means that the taste is like the main thing itself. And basically what that principle teaches us is that if something is considered to have halachic taste, and I call it halachic taste because although once upon a time, the Shulchan Aruch sort of describes getting your local sort of non-Jewish neighbor to taste things and tell you whether you can taste the meat or not, that is not something we have done for many, 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 many years. We're basically, the basic halachic principle is that if something has more than 1 in 60 in it, then it's considered to have imparted taste. And if it has less than 1 in 60 in it, then it's considered not to have imparted taste. And that's why I refer to it as halakhic taste, because it keeps things simpler, and we're just sort of focusing on it from this legal perspective. But the idea is that something that has absorbed taste is considered to have absorbed that sort of status itself. So if it let's say, for example, you use your so how does this work? Let's see if we've got it over here. No, okay, we'll come back to it. So how does this work? Let's say you cook to use Lynn's example, let's say you cook something with meat in a meat pot, right? Then that meat is assumed to have absorbed a small amount of taste from the meat. And therefore, the pot is now considered to be meaty. The same thing with a spoon, the same thing with a piece of cheese, for example, right? So if you drop your piece of cheese into your chicken soup, right, then that cheese is considered to have absorbed taste, even once you take it out, even once you wash it off, right? It's obviously still considered to be a meat and milk mixture, and therefore that's a problem. And if a pot has been used for non-kosher, then again, it's considered to have absorbed taste into the walls. And that is very, very, again, that's a very, very key part of the law of kosher. And that's why we have this principle of utensils, right? So milk utensils, meat utensils, non-kosher utensils, Pesach utensils, all of that is based on this principle of taste, that absorption of taste is considered to be like the substance itself. It takes on that same status. Now, in principle, if something something is only considered to have absorbed halakhic taste when it's hot, and not when it's cold. And therefore, this is where many times we rely on this, you know, at least sort of on a one-off, right? We wouldn't recommend this people to have this in their home. But let's say you go to a restaurant, right? So you can, in principle, assuming the food itself is kosher or whatever, you know, whatever you're having a salad, you're having a whatever, a Coke or a water or whatever it may be, you can use the utensils. It doesn't matter what those utensils have been used for, because everything that you're having is cold, and therefore there's assumed to be no absorption of taste, no problem of using that, even if they are quote unquote non-kosher utensils. The fork, the knife, the plate, glass, all those sorts of things. Again, as I said, in principle, as a here and there, that is all permitted because there's no absorption of taste when it's cold as opposed to hot. Now, other ways in which we're going to help to come back to our spoon and our pot, right? One of the ways in which we're going to be able to salvage this spoon is if the taste that was absorbed is going to be considered negative taste. Okay, and this again is a very, very critical halakhic principle, what we call noten ta'am lifgam, that the taste that was imparted into this spoon or into this pot or whatever it may be, into this piece of food, is considered to be not taste that's sort of nice, you know, but something that the people would want to eat, but something that's negative, something pagum, what we call in halakha pagum, is considered to be no good, and therefore it actually won't really make a huge difference in halakha. Now again, we're going to come to a couple of exceptions, but in principle, after 24 hours, taste that is absorbed after 24 hours is considered to be pagum, is considered to be negative taste, and therefore won't be a problem. So, to lead that back into our examples that we're using, you have this spoon, this milky spoon, that was put into your chicken soup. The first question that any good rabbi will ask you is, when was the last time that spoon was used, right? And if you say, I used it in my cereal that morning, right? They will ask you, was your cereal hot, right? Because you have hot milky porridge. And if you answer no, right? And again, this spoon has not been used in more than 24 hours. Then the chicken soup is going to be fine. Even if it was just a tiny amount of chicken soup, even if there wasn't 60 times the amount of chicken soup, because the taste that we consider to have gone, this is now not taste imparting into a utensil, taste as it were coming out of the utensil, right? This milky spoon is considered to be infused with a milky sort of, milky taste, taken on this halakhic status of milk. But the taste that is coming out, because it's 24 hours old, because it has not been used in that amount of time, is considered to be negative taste, it's considered to be what we call pagum, and therefore that will be okay. This is our biggest saving grace. This happens, I would say, you know, most of the time. This is what sort of saves people, that you're usually not sort of dipping from one straight into another. It's usually sort of a significant amount of time has elapsed between, it has to be a full day, it has to be 24 hours. Usually you get a sort of a day or so between these mishaps. And therefore, a lot of the time, that is what you're going to rely on. Okay, so as I said, we've talked about not in time, we've talked about things imparting taste, we've talked about taste going into the utensil, taste coming out of the utensil, and the fact that that this taste is considered to be hagum, is considered to be negative taste, but not considered to be sort of potent halakhically if it's after 24 hours. And actually, we'll take this one stage further, and I think, we'll pause the question soon. We'll take this one step further, just to add in that actually, if you use a substance that makes it taste bad, such as most regular soaps, right? Sometimes people say that some of the sort of modern soaps are not really so strong and actually doesn't taste so bad. But most of the time we say, as long as there's actually soap in there, right? Soap in there at the time, then that's also considered to be negative. It's not pleasant, nor is that, and therefore that's fine. So if you accidentally, again, this is probably the most common question, not by any particular person on this call, although it might be, but the most common question is, oops, I washed up the milky pot in the wrong sink, or I washed up the milky spoon in the wrong sink, or whatever it was, right? most of the time, even if you're using boiling hot water, right? So again, heat is also significant for transparency. Even if you're using boiling hot water, if you're using soap at the same time, if you're using soap at the same time, then that's usually your saving grace, because the taste that is being imparted from one into the other is considered to be negative taste, and therefore is not going to render it problematic. Okay. Now, again, we're dealing in all of these cases with everything being kosher, right? Everything being kosher. We're not talking about non-kosher taste here. We're talking about meat and milk mixing together, and therefore that mixture would be problematic. But if we're talking about the taste being not a pleasant taste, then that taste is not going to be problematic. Now, I'll just add one more question that we haven't answered, which is, I talked about the chicken soup being okay when you dip in, let's say you dip in the milky spoon into the chicken soup. The chicken soup might be okay because the spoon hasn't been used, but the spoon has gone into hot meat, right? Something which is hot and meaty, so that will have to come back. Okay, that will have to explain in a moment. I'm not going to go on to the second part of this slide because I want to pause for questions, in case of questions or comments or anything before we come back to this, because I know we've sort of thrown in a lot in there, and then we'll come back onto the second half of this slide in a moment. All right, any questions or comments? All right. Yes, you have a raised hand.
I have a question, yes. My mother taught me that if I mixed up the milk and meat cutlery, or whatever, by mistake, I could bury it in the ground for 3 days and it would be fine. I therefore have lots of knives, forks and spoons stuck into flower pots all over the place, for which my whole family think I'm totally mad. Was she correct, or is this an old wives' tale?
There's a rabbi I know who's actually trying to amalgamate a list of sort of the most common sort of things that have got mixed up over time with things. So I think this is going to make the list, actually. It's a good one, because it's not your mother. Everybody has this, and it does have its roots in Jewish law, but the way it's sort of developed is not quite the way that it's not quite sort of true to what it's supposed to be, and that is as follows. What the burying in the ground comes from is as follows. Before they had good soaps and things, So all of what we've been talking about now, we're talking about imparting taste. We're talking about a clean spoon, right? If it has bits of cheese on it, then that's different, because that is actual food on it. Okay, so actual food is different. We're talking about imparting taste. So what you used to do for when you had something that was dirty, that had, let's say you accidentally used your meat knife to cut a slice of cheese, right? So let's say you accidentally used your meat knife to cut a slice of cheese. Now, that's all cold, right? So in principle, there's no taste imparted, and that's fine. But you've still got a residue, right? A residue of cheese on your meaty knife, and that's no good. So what Halacha recommends is to dig it into the ground to remove the residue of cheese on it, right? Nowadays, what I would recommend you to do is just to wash it cold in a sink, just to use a bit of soap, and to wash it off in the sink, and that gets rid of the residue. But as I said, once upon a time, the recommended halachic way to remove that residue was to dig it into the ground. It's a really interesting one, because it's very, very common, and I know a lot of people who do that. But in principle, it's really more applicable to residue, to something which is actually sort of still visible and stuck onto the utensil, and it's really just designed to remove that. And if you could find a different way to do that, so with soap or something like that, then I think that's also at least as good.
But basically, you can just wash it then.
Sorry?
Basically, you just wash it then.
Correct, you just wash it off. Ideally, do it without hot water, although, as you said, if you do end up doing it with hot water and there's soap on it, then that's usually fine. But I recommend doing it with cold water just to avoid issues.
Rabbi, is it permitted to put milk dicker and flasher dicker crockery and cutlery in a dishwasher?
You put them in a milky dishwasher or in a meaty dishwasher. So that's a whole separate question.
You've got two dishwashers, or only got one.
So that's a good question. So we're not. That's a much more complex question, which we're not going to get to. and a subject of great debate. The general rule is that the Ashkenazi practice is not to do it. And Sephardim are slightly more lenient on this. Although it also, to be perfectly honest, also a little bit depends on your dishwasher. Some dishwashers, I believe, I'm not an expert in this, but from the there are halakhic research organizations, but I believe there are certain dishwashers which run a hot cycle of just water before they introduce any detergent, and that obviously causes more problems, because when there's detergent in that better, there's also problems of, you know, actual food in the tub is different to the taste imparted, so there's lots of factors that go into it. As a general rule, we try to ideally keep one dishwasher for milk or one dishwasher for meat. Yes. Dee or Mervyn, is that a new hand raised or is that the same hand raised?
Me.
Oh, it's a new one, yes.
Rabbi, we know that there's milk and meat and pariv.
Yes.
It was once suggested to me that Pyrex might be considered a pariv material, since it couldn't absorb any taste. Is that rubbish, or is that something in that?
These are great questions. I think we should do like a sort of a Q&A, the last one. I think maybe we're going to have to sort of try and find a good thing. It's definitely, very little of this is rubbish. It's all based in good, good principles. This has been much debated. I would say that, again, in general, the general practice is not to use Pyrex for hot things of both meat or of milk. But there are those who are a little bit more lenient with it, and particularly when it comes to kashering, right? Usually we often don't kasher. Well, we'll come back to kashering. Usually we don't kasher things other than metal implements, but there are those who sort of kasher glass, certain types of glass. And it's also, again, coming back to this, forgive me for this technicality, it does come back to also the types. And I'm not an expert, but there are different types of Pyrex, I believe, as well. And some of them are more problematic, some of them are less problematic. In principle, we do assume that everything absorbs taste to an extent. So as I said, some people have suggested that Pyrex doesn't absorb any taste whatsoever. I think the general practice is to assume that it does absorb some sort of taste, and therefore generally do avoid the mixing and matching between even Pyrex as well. But it's not rubbish, is the answer. It is based on something. Yeah.
But
coming back to the idea of Pyrex, yes, sorry, do you have another question?
Rabbi, I was just going to ask, it's the heat that's the problem. It's the fact that the Pyrex can take hot liquids, hot materials, hot food, isn't it?
Well,
you're more lenient with using glasses for milk and for meat, drinking glasses.
That's nothing to do with the substance. That's just to do with, that's true of plates and everything. If you're using it for coals, then it's always going to be simpler to do. But we're talking about the question, I think, is whether Pyrex, even when used with hot substances, is absorbing the taste of those hot substances.
Okay.
But now that you mentioned the word Pyrex, so that leads us very neatly on to this second half of this slide, which is as follows. That we talk about Pyrex, right? Pyrex is something that doesn't have meat and doesn't have milk. Now, for example, about a pot of pasta, right? Pasta is neither milk nor meat. Actually, my four-year-old has been learning a lot about meat and milk. So we get asked most meals, is this meaty, is this milky? Is chicken milky? Is pasta meaty? You know, we get asked all these things all the time. So is pasta milky, is pasta meaty? So the answer is obviously, generally it's pyrex. But what about if it's cooked in a utensil of sorts, right? So let's say you cook your pasta in your meat pot, right? And then you want to put cheese on it. Is that okay or is it not? So again, this actually comes to a very interesting debate between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Oh, there we go. And this is as follows, that the Shulchan Aruch actually says, he uses the example of an egg, but he says, Beitza shenit vashna b'mayim. Let's say you boil an egg in water. Bikhadera cholevet. So it's a lovely term. It means a sort of how do they call it a dairy pot here, but cholevet is like an active term. It sounds like you're milking the pot, right? It's not you're milking the pot, but the point is it's got potent milk taste. Okay, potent milk taste means you've used that pot recently for milk. You just boiled. You just cooked a nice bowl of porridge, let's say, for example, in that pot, and had hot milk in it. Then you clean it out, and now you boil some eggs in that same pot. The Shulchan Aruch says it is permissible to put them into chicken, right? Mutar la tetota, the tochtanagon, can eat that egg with chicken, no problem. Afili lechatkela, right? Aval imnit bashla bikadira imbasa, is that if it's got the meat in there, then obviously that's needed, right? So then you can't eat it with anything that's not. But the Rama is the general sort of Ashkenazi authority. He says that actually there are significant numbers. So I actually chopped it out here because it didn't fit on the slide. But he actually lists about seven different Rishonim who all say that actually this is problematic. And therefore, our practice is generally not to do this. But he then goes on. I also chopped off the end of this remark. He goes on to list all the exceptions. So we're talking about where you've literally just used or you've recently used this pot for milk. But let's say it's older than, let's say you haven't used the pot for 24 hours, right? And you want to cook pasta in this pot and you end up using it can you have cheese on that pasta? And the answer is yes. Okay, if you haven't used the pot for more than 24 hours and you want to have cheese on that pasta, obviously not while it's, sorry, just clarify, not while it's in the meaty pot, but after you put it onto a plate, then can you do that? The answer is yes, you can do that. I'll tell you another time this comes up a lot is with Shabbos cooking, right? So or particularly with Yontif, when you have lots and lots of things. So sometimes you cook, cooks a whole load of, let's say, for example, roast potatoes, right? You cook loads and loads of roast potatoes, and you know that over Yontif, over a few days of Yontif, you're going to have some meals where you're going to have those roast potatoes with meat, and some meals where you're going to have them with milk. Can anyone still hear me? I've lost everyone's picture, so I'm worried that they're... There we go.
We've lost you completely there.
I realised everyone's picture went.
No, we lost you for the
How long ago was I lost?
About 25 seconds.
Okay, you were just starting to talk about cooking over a long Yom Tov.
Okay, great. All right, let me try and I'm going to come out of this screen share and try and sort out my... it is still on this thing. Okay, I don't know which internet connection is worse. All right, we'll try it one more time. Anyway, so we'll leave the slides off. Maybe that will help for a bit. So as you said, if you haven't used this utensil for more than 24 hours, then you can, in a sense, sort of use the pared food for both. So let's say you're going to cook for a long time. So if you want to cook a load of roast potatoes, you know that some of your meals are going to have them with meat. Some of your meals are going to have those potatoes with milk, right? Is that a problem? The answer is no. That's fine, as long as the oven hasn't been used for meat for 24 hours and the tray hasn't been used for meat for 24 hours. So what my very astute wife often does is she cooks sort of all the pyre of ingredients before she cooks the meat ingredients. So if you cook the meat and then you cook the potatoes straight afterwards, then that's more problematic. But if you cook the potatoes first, then the oven hasn't been used for a while beforehand, then you can end up using those potatoes for different meals. Again, unless you've served them directly with meat or something like that. But assuming they're all still pyre, then that is fine. Because here we come back to the slideshow. Here we come on to another critical principle, which is what we call noten ta'am bar noten ta'am. It's like two steps removed. So this is infusion of taste and infused back in the taste, the meat, quote unquote, in these potatoes is meat that has gone into an oven once, or into the tray through what was cooked on it, and then back out into the potato. So that's what we call in the acronym up here is nut bar nut. Not in time bar, not in time. It's like a two-step process, second degree, and therefore that's much more sort of relaxed that. Coming back to our spoon, right? Again, this is based on everything that we've talked about. This is the basic answer to sort of the original question, and then we'll introduce some much more complicated. We'll get to some much more complicated ones in the ramifications of this in a moment. But in principle, you put the meat spoon into your chicken soup, or I've done it the other way. You put your meat spoon into milk liquid. You dip your meat spoon into your porridge. Right? Was the spoon used in the last 24 hours? If the answer is no, then it's fine. The porridge is fine. Okay. If the answer is yes, then you have to ask yourself whether there was a large amount of porridge. If there was a large amount of porridge, more than 60 times the amount of porridge, then again, it's fine. And if not, then yes, you can have a problem. Most of the time, these sorts of things will be okay. What you have to do with a spoon, let's pause on that for a little bit. Okay, any questions before we go on? All right, so I thought anyway, everyone's welcome to unmute for the next part. Okay, if you want. So we're going to try and throw in a few different scenarios and we'll sort of see if anyone wants to volunteer their head for the chopping board and see, see whether you want to take a stab at any of these. Okay, so Tony uses a meaty spoon to serve and eat his hot macaroni and cheese. Okay, what is the status of the spoon? What is the status of the remaining macaroni and cheese? And what is the status of the plate? Anyone want to volunteer before we take this?
I think that the macaroni and cheese is okay. The spoon's not. I don't know anything about the plates.
Okay, very good. So the spoon, so the macaroni and cheese, it's going to slightly depend, right? As we said, it depends when the spoon was last used. But yes, most of the time, it's going to be okay. So the spoon is a very interesting one. The spoon, let's say the spoon wasn't used in the last 24 hours. It actually, it's a very unique state. It's very unusual status in halakha. It's usually if you mix meat and milk together, that's called non-kosher. So this spoon is not non-kosher. This spoon is technically kosher, but it's both meat and milk because it absorbed a kosher meat taste and it absorbed a kosher milk taste, right? Now, it's a very odd one. It's a bit of a sort of catch-22. And therefore, what we do in principle is we do try and we should kasher this spoon, right? We should kasher this spoon. If you didn't, then again, if it wasn't used in the last 24 hours, then usually it's going to be okay. But we do try and kasher the spoon because it's sort of catch 22 otherwise, basically. And in terms of the plate is also usually fine. If the food is going to be fine, then the plate is also going to be okay because the plate is as it were, is taking its status from the food itself. Okay. Now this
so
is
in a world where that happens. I'm very confused. I don't know if I'm tired. In the world where that happens, would you just and you've eaten and then you think, oh, that was a meat spoon or whatever. Would you just wash everything up and go back to as it was? Or should I take my spoon to Erica's and shove it in a plant pot?
You should kasher the spoon. You should kasher the spoon. We're going to come back. Definitely not the plant pot because that doesn't work for the for actual kashering. That only works to get rid of the residue okay. If you're digging it in. We'll come back to kashering. We'll come back to kashering at the end. Okay, how you do it in a bit. Oh, I'm getting close. So, okay. So now let's move on to case number two. Lucy, so this is something we haven't discussed. She opens the milky drawer to find a meaty knife, but she doesn't know what it was used for or how it was washed up. Can the knife be used? So the answer is that anyone want to take a stab at this? No pun intended.
I'd go with Erica's plant pot.
Yeah, you've got to kosher the knife.
Yeah,
just in case.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to disagree with both of you actually. So the plant pot, as we said, we're gonna try and get rid of the plant pot because the plant pot doesn't work. If you get to the stage where you've got something on the knife, we're better off using soap. But in terms of cashering, I'll tell you a few reasons this won't need cashering. The first one is that this is a principle which, to be fair, I haven't introduced. So that's a bit of cheating. But the general rule is if you're not sure when something was last used, there is a principle of what's called stam kalim einam b'niyamon, which means that most utensils, you'll remember if you've used them very recently. And therefore, if you're not sure whether you've used them recently, we're going to assume that you haven't. And therefore, the taste will be secondary taste, it's going to be older taste. And therefore, that's already helping you. The other thing is when we're washing up, most of the time, people are washing up with soap. So again, in these sorts of cases, we're talking about multiple layers removed from sort of meat and milk mixing together. And we're talking about cases where most of the time it's going to be fine. And therefore, I actually wouldn't say that you need to cash the knife. I believe that's the general practice. If you find it, I would say you should be more careful, right? But I wouldn't say you need to kosher the knife if you find it in there. You can assume it was washed up even if it was washed up accidentally in your meaty sink. We'll assume there was soap in there, and just to be more careful.
Would you not want to wash the meaty knife before putting it back in its right drawer?
If it looks clean, then there's no need. If it looks like it's got, yes, some cheesy residue on it, then yes, I would. but if it doesn't, most of the time these things look well. Yeah, if you pull it out the drawer and it looks clean, then I'd say it's clean.
All these years that I've been mixing them up.
If you want to make it dirty, you can put it in the plant pot, but it doesn't help you.
All my plant pots full of cutlery.
Yeah.
Three days.
Surely he's going to be renting out plant pots in future. If you want to come along and buy one.
Abby's grandma also does this as well. Despite having, I think, was it five? I can't remember how many, however many rabbinic grandchildren she has, she still does. She still buries her cutlery. So there you go. Okay. So now we have, let's move on to a few of the others, because I'm conscious of time, and we want to talk about cashing if we can. Maybe we'll take one more. Let's skip number three and do four and five quickly. Okay, so you're away on holiday, okay, no kosher establishments nearby, and you buy fish with fins and scales, which again, in principle, is fine. If you, just as a sort of, there's loads of kosher on holiday, actually, maybe we should do this next week's topic. We could do it as a separate topic. In principle, if you find a fish, even if you just see the scales on it, that's fine. Torah says that anything which has scales automatically has fins in it, and this is yet to be, believe it or not, the creator of the Torah was the same creator of all the fish. So he knew what he was talking about, and again, this still works, but all fish with scales also have fins and therefore will be kosher. But the fishmonger uses his regular knife, right? Can you still eat the fish, right? The fishmonger uses his regular knife. So I'm not going to open this one just for time's sake. Generally, I would ask either you should sort of ask him to wash it. If you're there, you should ask him to wash his knife beforehand, depending on the look on his face and how he's holding the knife at the time. But otherwise, if you're concerned, let's say that he just used the same knife to cut a shark or something, to cut a shark up, and now he's cutting your one up, so you could just, you wash it off wash off your fish quite well, and that's fine. We're talking about residue here. There's no transfer of taste that's happened. There's no heat. There's no transfer of taste. This fish has not absorbed non-kosher taste. It may have residue on it. Yes, that's a significant concern. I don't mean to minimize that. And that's something obviously that should be checked. But otherwise, it's fine to do. Okay, let's do the next one. So this is actually very similar to the first question I ever got, which was highly problematic. And that is, you cook your milky omelette with a meaty spatula in your meat frying pan that was used on the same day. So what actually happened when I, the question I received is someone had fried their schnitzels and they'd realized that they'd used their butter instead of margarine. So they use their meat spatula and their meat frying pan, and they use butter instead of margarine. That was highly problematic. That's very hard to help with. But in this case, right, again, it's going to be problematic. So the milky omelette, right, the milky omelette was cooked in a meat frying pan that was used the same day for meat. That's very significant, because it was used that day for meat, considered to have what we call live meat taste, right? It's considered to have real, not live meat, but I guess, you know, real sort of potent meat taste, I'll say, and that is being imparted into this omelette. The only thing you're going to end up relying on is what we call bittel beschissen, right? It's 1 in 60. Most of the time, that's also not true. If you have an omelette within a frying pan, the frying pan is not usually 6 times the size of the omelette. So therefore, yeah, this will be quite problematic. Okay. So before we go on to the next thing, I'll just say a very quick word about kashering, which really could be a topic in and of itself. A lot of this could be a topic in and of itself. I'm conscious that we're only doing 3 weeks on this, so I wasn't going to address a lot of these things, but I'm happy to try and focus next week at least on some of the questions that people want to answer. But in principle, I'll say a very quick word about kashering. Let's come at this. In principle, I'll say a very quick word about kashering, and that is as follows. Generally, we only kasher things which are made of metal. Okay, we only kasher things which are made of metal. Things which are made of porcelain, like plates and things like that, we tend not to kasher them, except in cases of great need. So again, ask, you know, specific questions are welcome, but generally we don't kasher porcelain. The way you do that is based on what we call in halacha kabolo kach polta. So the extent, the level to which it absorbed the taste is the level to which you need to then expunge the taste to sort of take it out again. So most of the time, that will be that you have cooked something in that pot, and therefore you need to cook the taste, as it were, back out of the pot. So to use, I think, Lynn's example from the beginning, if you used your pot for meat and then you want to change it over, which we shouldn't do, which we don't do regularly, but you know, as a one-off, what you need to do is basically boil up the water, okay, in the pot, have it really sort of hot, fill it to the top, and what you want to do is you want that to spill over. So I'm assuming the brick was put in just as a sort of, it doesn't need to be a brick, you can put in anything which is going to sort of make the water then sort of spill over the sides. Obviously do this carefully, do this safely, and do it in a way, you know, in a place where you're going to be able to clean up and not get in trouble afterwards.
Boil up the pot
and make it spill over the sides. Yes. Sorry, Lynn.
When he did it, it really was. I mean, I'm wondering, we didn't get scalded. It was just going everywhere, and the shul kitchen floor was completely covered. I mean, it was unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it.
Okay. As I say, you should definitely do it carefully. You should definitely do it safely. But in principle, that's what we do. If you're doing it with cutlery, all you need to do is drop it in your boiling pot of water. So you boil up your pot of water. If anyone wants to see how crazy people do that, I made a video just before Pesach last year where I did that with my cutlery. So you're welcome to watch that. That's how you do it. That's how you can do it with anything. You could do that with one knife or with all your knives. That's for things which have been sort of cooked. The problem, or not problem, but that's basically what we call in halacha shag'ola. Shag'ola means sort of boiling the taste out, basically. And the other way that people do it is sometimes you might have seen in northwest London a lot of the time before Pesach, they set up massive vats of boiling water and they dip into those big vats. That's just for convenience. It should have 60 times the amount that's going in, but again, they sort of dip stuff in. When you have an oven or something like that, that's more difficult, because that the taste has been absorbed at a much higher temperature than just boiling, right? Than just boiling in liquids, something which has been cooked sort of without the liquids, or, you know, roasted or cooked within an oven. That's a bit more difficult to do. I will go on record as saying, and I mean this sincerely, I will go on record as saying that blow torches should not be used on modern ovens. They don't kasher the oven, and they don't, and it's dangerous to do, so don't use a blowtorch. The sort of I would say that the more legitimately lenient end of the spectrum is that you turn your oven on high for a significant length of time, usually around an hour or so, you know, to sort of get it to its highest temperature for a significant period of time, half an hour or so. But ovens is really, again, is a whole big topic which we'll leave aside. But as I say, blowtorches, not a good idea. I don't go for blowtorches at all, because I'll tell you a very simple reason. A blowtorch, if you're going according to that halakhic opinion that you need to blowtorch something to get it red hot, then you're going to do one of two things to your oven. You're either going to wave it around in your oven where it doesn't actually get red hot, or you're going to melt your oven and break the thermostat on the oven. So it just doesn't sort of work either way. If you end up with an oven that's working at the end, then it's probably not kosher still. And if you don't have an oven that's working in the end, then you didn't need to bother koshering it in the first place. So that's my practical advice. And the only other thing I'll mention now, and then I'm happy to stop for questions or for people to tell me what we want to talk about next time, because I have ideas, but actually I'm sort of relatively open to what we do for the future. And that is as follows. The only other things to mention is that actually there's some great websites out there to you can get all sorts of questions. Particularly the London Bedouin has some good stuff, and certainly for sort of kosher products, isitkosher.uk is great. But I would say that the Star K and the OU, both really, you know, two of the world's top kosher organizations, have great Q&A sections. So people have asked all the sort of classic questions that come up, all the things about, you know, whatever, on holiday, and all these sorts of questions. You can find all sorts of Q&A on there. And really, really, as you can see on here, they've got Sabbath mode appliances, a whole section on that as well. All sorts of really, really interesting things that you can find on these websites. And so feel free to take a screenshot, you know, to sort of peruse any of these websites if you're interested. And otherwise, I think we'll leave it there for this week, but open to suggestions of what we want to do for future, or questions on what we've done until now.